Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicagoan Bill Ayers is well known for his activism, teaching, and writing. And this weekend, he's holding a discussion group in Chicago that he says is designed to have serious and challenging conversation for these days. He calls it Singing in Dark Times. And he's on the line with me now. Hi, Bill. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you very much for having me.
Happy New Year.
And to you.
You know, I was going to describe you as a, quote, progressive activist. And then I thought, that's a new word that people use to describe the left. And I wondered how you felt about that term.
Well, I haven't really given it much thought except to say that I guess I am progressive. I'm a progressive teacher. I am an activist. But I've always thought of myself more as a revolutionary. And by that, I don't mean anything grandiose so much as I mean that we have to get to the root of problems. We have to go deeper than we're used to going. And it's not a matter of, cosmetic change at the top or a few icons being brought low. It's a matter of changing the structures that kind of perpetuate oppression of women in this moment, of African Americans and others. So, yeah, I've always thought of myself as a radical or a revolutionary. But sure, you can call me a progressive activist. I don't put much stock in labels anyway.
So I wonder, as we think about this past year, as we think about 2017, what you find especially troubling is the word that you use to describe these times. What in particular for you?
Well, I mean, I think that almost everybody I know, and I think most of the world, feels that we're in troubling times, difficult times. And the title of this little event that I'm curating every month at 57th Street Bookstore is Singing in Dark Times, and it's from a little fragment of a poem from Bertolt Brecht. And the fragment says, "In the dark times, will there be singing?" And his answer is, "Yes, there will be singing, singing about the dark times." And my idea was that we would gather together with artists, poets, writers, fellow citizens, and kind of generate a public conversation about these times. To me, what's troubling about these times is the rise of nationalism, the rise of jingoism, the rise of war fever, the threat of nuclear annihilation, the climate catastrophe, which I know is called climate change or sometimes catastrophic climate change. I tend to, again, talking about words, I tend to favor predatory capitalist environmental destruction or something like that, to make it clear that we have choices and we are facing a really, really troubling moment in world history. And all those elements are part of it, and certainly the ascendancy of the Trump administration is part of it, but it's only part of it. And we have a lot of work to do to remind ourselves of our responsibility as citizens, as moral people, as people who want to leave a better world for our children and grandchildren. And it feels urgent to me in a way that it almost has never felt quite this urgent before.
I wanted to ask you about, in particular, nuclear annihilation. I think that's something that we think about. You know, there were sort of different periods when you look back on American history. Certainly during the Cold War, there were kind of the whole idea of kids doing drills. Do you feel like now the threat is perhaps even more real? And I wonder also, do you think that we are taking it seriously?
Well, I think it's more real than it's been since I was a kid. I'm in my mid-70s, so I was in school in the 40s and the 50s, and I was one of those kids who dived under his desk during nuclear war drills. And I laugh because looking back on it, it's so preposterous. We all went under our desks, and then the teacher told us that when we got the all clear, if there were a nuclear blast, we should wash thoroughly. And I'm thinking now, all these years later, wash thoroughly? Good luck, you know.
If there was skin left, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, if you had anything left. But seriously, the atomic scientist group that has had the doomsday clock has moved the minute hand much, much closer to zero than it's ever been. And I think the fact that there are at least two leaders who have their fingers on the so-called nuclear button, one is bigger than the other, is a troubling thing. And the fact that they continue to taunt and threaten each other and show no real interest in serious diplomacy or discussion is a frightening kind of concept. I mean, Obama went into the White House saying he was going to do away with nuclear weapons, and that was a great aspiration. Of course, we did nothing of the kind, but it's something that we should hope for and be able to imagine, a world without nuclear weapons. And I think that the standoff with Korea right now and the threat to, you know, which the President of the United States made standing in front of the United Nations to annihilate 25 million people was quite breathtaking. I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like that. And we can say, oh, well, poo-poo, it's just Donald Trump. I don't buy that. I think you stand in front of a world forum like that and make that kind of comment, it has real implications in the world of real politics. So, yeah, I'm worried, definitely worried.
And I think I guess my question is there's so many things going on right now. If you look at the world and you look at America and you look at the year that we've had, when you think about just the nuclear context, do you think that sometimes there might be so many other things that people are thinking about, whether it's the rise of white supremacists are certainly being more vocal and forward and open about white supremacy, or if we think about immigration and immigrants or hate crimes or all of these other things that we could, the Me Too movement, there's sort of all of these things I think right now that we're talking about. Do you think it's kind of hard to, do you think in a way that it's hard to focus on just one thing, or do you think things are getting crowded out or lost, like climate change or nuclear weapons?
Well, probably. And I think your description is right of the kind of challenges confronting us. And in terms of white supremacy, I think your description is absolutely correct. And I would simply add that the white supremacist group has been more coherent than I've seen it in 50 years. So there's a coherence to it that was lacking. There's always a base for white supremacy in our history and in our culture and in our society, but it's coherent. And sure, you're right. We could easily crowd some things out because the enormity of the task. But there's another possibility, and that is that we look at these issues as connected and we look at our response as connected. That is, instead of seeing the Me Too movement and the struggle for Black Lives Matter and the struggle for indigenous rights and the struggle against war and the struggle for immigrant rights and so on, instead of seeing them as separate issues, why can't we also take a great leap of imagination and imagine that we have to confront all these issues simultaneously, not because they're identical, but because there's no contradiction between them? In other words, I have no problem fighting for 15 at the same time saying that I'm a socialist. I have no problem fighting to do away with nuclear weapons and at the same time say, I want a world at peace. I want to disarm altogether. These things don't seem in contradiction to me. Women's liberation is not in contradiction to Black liberation. So I want to imagine that we could take a great leap in our consciousness and confront these disparate issues in a comprehensive and coherent way. And in that way, maybe take a great leap forward in this time of fragmentation and despair.
I'm speaking with Bill Ayers, an activist, educator, author, Chicagoan. And Bill, you know, as you say that, as you mentioned sort of the fragmentation, I think the other thing that we kind of can characterize what we saw last year in particular was something you said, that resistance is breaking out all over. And I guess as I ask you about that, I wonder, is it sort of the nature of things that people are have passion around one thing, whether it's, you know, as we're talking about the disparate movements that have sprung up. Do you think that part of the problem is that there are, the nature of it is that there, whether it's Black Lives Matter or the Women's March, that it's like different groups coming together and not necessarily having that sense of cohesion?
Well, we have a responsibility, those of us who think about progressive alternatives. We have a responsibility to find the overlaps and to find the links. In Chicago, there's been a group meeting for almost a year, 36 separate organizations trying to hammer out a common agenda, and they call themselves R3, Reimagine, Resist, and Rebuild. It's a fascinating kind of process, and of course we don't come to the table all of us in total agreement to begin with. But when we sit down and talk, and when we figure out what it is we're opposed to and what the alternative might be, that becomes in itself a powerful force. And it's certainly the case that with all social change, it's not enough to be aggrieved. It's not enough to know what's wrong. There has to emerge the sense of possibility. We only act, we only take risks when there's a possible world sitting beyond the world as such that we can actually get our hands around. You think about the great black freedom movement of the 50s and 60s. Black people in the South knew that they were oppressed. They knew that they were being exploited. But it was when some magical thing happened, which was a huge number of people began to think, if I go down and register to vote, if I take that risk, my world will change and my children's world will change. When that became an ethos, then we changed. And I think that's what I see emerging as a possibility. It's not a certainty, but certainly when I look at the R3 groups meeting, I'm very hopeful that we can find a way forward. I think also interesting, Black Lives Matter in Chicago, led by these young people who really are quite young. They're in their early 20s, some of them are teenagers. And like the teenagers who powered the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, these kids are not saying Black Lives Matter only. They're saying we're looking at the world through a Black, queer, feminist lens. And as we look at the world that way, we can imagine a world that would be more coherent and better for all of us, not just for Black people, not just for queer people, not just for women, but for all of us.
Bill, a lot of, I think, when you talk about the transition to a movement and to change happening, has to do with discourse, right? And it has to do with how many people are become engaged in an issue. We think about the civil rights movement and how it moved into the quote-unquote mainstream. And I wonder, as you kind of, if we've been sort of talking about the fragmentation of not just, I think, where we perhaps are as a country, but also the way that we consume news and information and the public square, how do you see that changing?
Well, I mean, that's really what this little discussion group that I'm curating is really trying to be a part of. That is to say, we're living in an era when the public is being erased, the public is being eclipsed, and it's being eclipsed in all kinds of ways. And, you know, the attack on public education right now is kind of the last bastion of a public space that we hold in common, that we hold in value. I think we have to fight for the public square. We have to create conditions where more of us, more of the time, can find venues where we can talk to one another without masks, without preconditions, and actually find a way to create a public. And when I say create a public, I mean like the great civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. That was the creation of a public space out of nothing. And I think that that's our task, that's our responsibility. And frankly, I think that's how change comes. I don't think it comes from a change of heart in the great powerful. I think it comes when enough people on the bottom, on the ground, say we've had enough of this and there has to be an alternative and we demand an alternative. That's when real change comes. I mean, Lyndon Johnson wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement, but he passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. Roosevelt wasn't part of the labor movement, and Lincoln wasn't part of the abolitionist movement, but they did great things when it was required only because there were movements on the ground of people, and that's what we have a responsibility to build.
Bill, I remember when we talked about this just after the election, or perhaps right before, I think it was actually just before the inauguration of President Trump last year, we talked about how we talked about reaching out. And from your perspective, as someone who's on the left, reaching out to the right. And I wanted to ask you how you think that went for you in the past year.
Well, I've never had a problem. A lot of the labels of left and right actually don't apply, you know, in my view. And often I've been in situations where people have come to talks I've given and so on with the assumption that we would have great disagreements, and we find common spaces, common edges. So there's a lot of propaganda out there that says, for example, everything public, everything done by the government is wrong, and yet everybody likes, you know, having a public road, an interstate. So, you know, we need to find where we really agree and where we disagree. And I actually think that the kinds of the kind of world that I project, that I imagine, the kind of world that would be at peace, in balance, living in harmony with nature, not conquering nature. The United States is a nation among nations, not the Uber nation, a nation where racial reconciliation was the name of the game. That's a world I think everybody would want to embrace, almost everybody. And so I approach conversations with people, I approach organizing, I approach teaching with that spirit, the spirit that we can find the common ground, and what's good for some of us, a few of us, is typically good for all of us.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bill Ayers about politics, about change. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'm talking to Bill Ayers, a Chicagoan, as an activist, an educator, and an author. Tomorrow at 6 o'clock, if you're in Chicago at the 57th Street Bookstore, he's going to be convening an event he calls Singing in These Dark Times. It's a gathering of artists, of authors, of folks who want to talk. Bill, this is something you're doing on a monthly basis?
Yes. You know, I've hosted a book event at 57th Street Bookstore for the last 3 years with the lunatic name of Fresh Airs, but I host different authors who are coming through Chicago, and I approach
Fresh
the
Airs, A-Y-E-R-S.
Exactly, exactly. They you know, Rick Perlstein. Rick had done a series of events there, and they called it Rickopedia, and they couldn't find anybody with the intellectual heft of Rick, so they went with the pun, and now we've got Fresh Airs. But in any case,
okay.
I've been doing that for years, and I approached the people at the bookstore, and I said, you know, this is a destination bookstore. This is a public space. This is a place people come for conversation. Let's not do one around the book. Let's have a gathering just around the times we're living in, naming the political moment, asking ourselves, where are we on the clock of the universe, asking ourselves the question, what does it mean to be human today? And with those kind of big questions, we have assembled poets, artists, writers, authors, and citizens of Chicago. And we've had some pretty spirited conversations. So that's what's going to continue tomorrow night.
Bill, when you mention this political moment, I was reading something you wrote recently about nostalgia that people seem to have for the, quote, good old days. And I'm thinking in terms of Republicans and many Democrats who say, who look back to President George W. Bush and they say, well, those were the good old days by their measure compared to now. I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, I mean, I think all nostalgia is painted in kind of rosy pastels, and it's mostly false. And I've, for years, as a person, kind of a charter member of the 60s generation, I have argued for years that there is no such thing as the 60s. It never existed. It's mostly myth and symbol. And for any old people, folks my age, you know, today, that now we're in 1968, which is the 50th anniversary of virtually everything because it's 50 years beyond 1968. But the reality is that nobody looked at their watch on December 31st, 1969 and said, oh my God, it's almost over. What'll I do now? Nobody lives by decades. That's marketing. So what I'm arguing in that piece that you read is that I'm kind of irritated with people, old people who are looking nostalgically at a ship that already left the shore. And I also think it's discouraging to young people to say, oh, well, the 60s, we had everything right. The reality is we had very little right. And the kids today are smarter, sharper, more informed. And there were things we had that were important, and we could talk about that. But I wanted to get us beyond the idea that the good old days ever existed. And certainly harking back to George Bush, harking back to Richard Nixon and saying, wow, it was so much better then. He was for child care. He was for environmental protection. But get over it. We're living now and we're looking forward. We can learn from history, but we should not be trapped in it. And we certainly shouldn't surround ourselves with a nostalgia for a time that really never existed.
That said, I wonder how, as you said, not thinking nostalgically is one way you probably do this, but I wonder how you have seen your activism change from the 60s, how you keep learning and incorporating more information into your worldview and allowing it to shift.
Well, you know, I think the important thing to remember is that being an activist or being a good citizen or being a moral person, there's a rhythm to it. And the rhythm is you have to open your eyes and pay attention. Then you have to be astonished at everything you see, both astonished at the beauty and the ecstasy all around, and be astonished at the unnecessary suffering that we visit upon one another. And then you have to act. And then the fourth step is you have to doubt. And in my early years, if there was one thing I forgot to do, it was to doubt. I always was sure I was right. But I think that rhythm keeps you alive to this moment. That is, opening your eyes isn't something you do once and then put on automatic pilot. That's dogma. What you have to do is open your eyes every day, at every moment, and say, what's the situation now? And since we're living in a dynamic history that's charging forward, we never can get it completely right. But we open our eyes, we are astonished, we act, we doubt, and we continue. So that's what keeps me alive. And I would say that my activism through the years has incorporated many, many, many things, but it's not about tactics and it's not about about small things. It's about an attitude that says we can do better and we ought to open our eyes and see the possibilities so that we can act on those possibilities.
Bill, I know you and I have had discussions in the past about whether or not you're an optimist. We will avoid that label, but I wonder if you, it sounds like you still have a lot of hope and faith in our democratic institutions in this country and the process and investing in that for change?
Well, I have a lot of hope. And to me, hope is different than optimism. Hope is knowing that you don't know what's coming. Optimists think they know what's coming. So do pessimists. I have no idea what's coming. And the day before any revolution, it seems impossible. And the day after, we all say it was inevitable. So Rosa Parks, the day before she sat in on the bus, the civil rights movement was not possible. The day after, it was inevitable. Let's remember that. And I think that I'm full of hope and hope, and I have a lot of energy towards possibility. Whether the institutions can bear it or not, I'm not certain. But I am certain that I have hope in ordinary people, and I believe that as long as we're alive, there should be hope, and hope is a choice. And as long as we're active, there's possibility. So that's why I'm a hopeful, activist.
Bill, you talking about hope makes me think of Oprah Winfrey's Golden Globe speech. I don't know if you saw it or heard about her speech on Sunday.
I who didn't hear about it?
Right.
And if you have your eyes open, you heard about it. I saw it, and I'm not a award show junkie. I was absolutely glued to the TV. I couldn't get over it. From the opening minute, I thought it was one of the most exciting and interesting collection of conversation speeches. And when Oprah Winfrey got up, and I'm not a huge Oprah Winfrey fan, I am now a fan. I thought she nailed it, and she kind of summed up the evening. I was a little disappointed, as a lot of people were, that the men kind of mainly remained silent on the issue. But what the heck? I'm willing to say they were listening for a change. But in any case, it was an exciting thing, and I thought Oprah Winfrey's talk was magnificent. Now, I think you have to take that rhetoric and say, what does it mean in terms of building the kinds of grassroots movement that we need to affect change, not just aspirational speaking, but digging in and working. And I think that's what we need to do.
Well, and I wanted to ask you, as a man, as a white man, what you have thought about the Me Too movement, what you've learned from it. And I wonder if it's changed your thinking or taught you some things.
Oh, my God. I think that I feel like the Me Too movement was an absolute jolt to me, and I think to so many other people, men and women. But I think that I've learned a ton of things, partly things that I never wanted to learn. I didn't know how weirdly perverse people were. I thought I knew everything about that, but I don't. And I also think that it matters that there's been an education, a public education around these issues, so that we understand that what may seem casual or comedic is not in the context of the power relations between men and women. So I feel like I'm still learning. I feel like when I was young and the feminist movement began and grew out of SNCC and SDS and other venues, I learned so much then so fast, and because of strong women, powerful women around me making demands. And I feel like I'm in that space again, and so I'm loving it. I also think that we have to, we men, we white people, have to remember that as allies, it is our job partly to listen. And it's also our job to say, I'm not just an ally in some patronizing, charitable sense, but I actually don't want to live in a world of white supremacy. I don't want to live in a world of male supremacy. I'd rather live in a world of equality. And that will mean making changes institutionally. Like, you know, I'm blown away by somebody like Mitch McConnell saying, I believe the women. Do you really? If you believe the women, do you believe they should have charge of their own uteruses? Do you believe they should be able to practice sexuality any way they want to? Do you believe they should have equal pay for equal work and the right to universal health care? If you believe the women, believe all of it and change those structures, and that will be a big step towards changing the kind of attitudes of sexism and male supremacy.
That's Bill Ayers. If you want to join him for more conversation, if you're in the Chicago area, you can catch him tomorrow night at the 57th Street Bookstore. Bill, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you, Nyla. I appreciate you very much. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The Nordic countries kick our asses so badly. I remember watching, you know, by the way, cross-country skiing is not really a spectator sport either. I remember I did happen to watch some the last Winter Olympics, and, you know, all the Nordic women were, because that's how they go get their bread and stuff, for heaven's sakes. Yeah. You know,
but, reindeer, you know, steaks.
The U.S. women were, like, way back. They were texting each other. They weren't, they weren't really even trying. They just gave it up for the, it doesn't, we don't seem to take those kinds of sports as seriously as we might.
You probably recognize that voice as that of Paula Poundstone. She's not only one of America's most well-known stand-up comics, but you may have heard her on a little public radio program called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's known for her improvisational sets and for never doing the same act twice. Over the years, she's also become an author and a host. Her most recent book is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She's also hosted the NPR podcast Live from the Poundstone Institute. She's performing this evening in Champaign at 7:30 at the Virginia Theater, and she's on the line now. Hi, Paula. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Paula, we'll get to talking about Wait, Wait in a minute, but I want to start by asking you about doing stand-up. One of the things you're especially good at is bantering with the audience during your set. And a writer for the Boston Globe once wrote that you're able to aggressively question audience members without ever seeming threatening. Have you always been comfortable with this kind of interaction?
It's the fun part of the night. I mean, I, you know, I have material and I like to tell myself it's good. But the real joy of the night is watching things unfold that, you know, I knew were in there somewhere, but I wasn't quite sure where. And my manager always tells people that I know just who to talk to, which couldn't be a bigger line of BS. I have no idea who to talk to. Everybody you talk to is great.
So you don't, when you are engaging with the audience members, you don't single out people that you think will be especially good conversation?
I single people out, but I don't have any idea who they are or everybody. You get everybody talking. They're just great.
Yeah, that's kind of risky, though, isn't it?
Well, I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen is that, you know, I won't be able to think of anything all that entertaining to say, and I move along. Whereas, you know, if I worked at Lawrence Livermore Labs, I think, you know, one wrong move and we all blow up. So there's not like a huge downside that can take place. Every now and then, you know, I'll say, I really just use the time-honored, where you from, what do you do for a living? And every now and then, somebody will say, well, you know, I'm, a software developer, and I feel myself start to glaze over ever so slightly. But that's when I use my clever, what do you do in your free time? Rejoinder.
So, Paula, I wonder if there's ever an on and off switch with that, right? Because you obviously love talking to people, but I wonder how often you're out in the world and maybe not feeling like talking to members of the public that way?
You know, I love people. I really, honestly, sincerely love people. And one of the things that I notice happening in our world as a whole is that because of electronics, and there's no question at all what the villain is, people are less and less accessible. I wish every day was like the opening scene in Beauty and the Beast, you know, bonjour, bonjour. I really do feel that's how it should be. That's how it was, you know, even when I was growing up in a small town in Massachusetts. People said hello. Maybe they weren't genuinely interested in your answer, but they went to the trouble of having a little exchange. And now sometimes you say hello to people and they have a headset on. You know, I can be having a really bad day and someone says, oh, you know, I love you on Wait, Wait. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, thank you. You know, so maybe, you know, maybe if I were some huge star, I would feel differently, but I can't imagine so. This idea that you don't like your fans is an idea that is foreign to me.
Yeah.
You know, like why, even if I was Beyonce, and I would admit that I've missed that by a country mile, but even if I was, why would I go to the trouble of pursuing audiences throughout my life and then turning on them when they want to talk to me? You know, years ago, when I wrote my first book, which was called There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say, the truth is, at that point in my life, I was kind of afraid of the audience members a little bit. Like, if after a show, I never wanted to talk to anybody right after a show, because I was afraid that they would come up and say, oh, I really enjoyed the show, and I'd say thank you, and they would feel like somehow that wasn't amusing enough. And then they'd feel like, oh, boy, I talked to her in person. She's really not that funny. And then I wrote this book, and, you know, sadly, my life of blatant self-promotion began. And so after the show, I would, you know, somebody would sell the books, and I'd be available to sign. This started maybe 16 years ago or so. Maybe not that long, but a long time ago. And what I found was I loved talking to the individuals, and I've always told the audience. Now I have some CDs and some T-shirts and another book. But I always tell the audience right from the very beginning of the show, you know, there's stuff of Bell. Yes, I'll sign. Yes, I'll take a picture. Yeah, I'll give you a hug. I'll shake your hand. And you do not have to buy anything. And it turns out it's part of the richest part of the night. I love meeting the people that come to see me. People say stuff like, they go, oh, we saw you, in Champaign, Illinois, and we saw you in Wisconsin, and we saw you on the Cape. I love that. Who wouldn't love that?
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Paula Poundstone. If you're in the Champaign area, she's actually going to be at the Virginia Theater this evening at 7:30. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Paula Poundstone, the stand-up comedian you also probably have heard on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, that public radio show. She's performing this evening at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, Illinois, but we've got her on the line now. So, Paula, you were saying that you originally used to be, you kind of didn't like that interaction, but I'm curious, did something change other than the need for self-promotion? Did you become a little bit more comfortable maybe with that whole idea of performance or when you saw people, or did you just stop caring
about?
No, I think what happened was when I actually did it, when I actually had, you know, more of those interactions after the show, I found that, you know, I really loved it. And I think part of what I feared before was the unknown. By the way, speaking of the unknown, you've now very quickly unearthed one of my worst traits for which I feel the deepest shame, which is that once I get started talking, I cannot shut up for the life of me.
Well, I think that's a pretty typical of most comedians, right?
Is it? Oh, I don't know. I think most comedians get invited to more dinner parties than I do. But a lot of people, you know, they once people get talking to me, they're like, oh, my God, I didn't realize that was going to happen.
I'm trying to think of who would be at the top. I mean, if you were going to have a dinner party for comedians, who would you invite?
I don't know if I know the answer to that question. If it was dead or alive, then I would.
Yeah, let's do dead, too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know how many I could have, and I don't know how well they'd get along. But the Three Stooges and Abbott and Costello.
Oh.
Yeah. I saw one time I think the Fine family owned this, Larry Fine of the Three Stooges. I believe that they loaned to the Three Stooges Film Festival in Glendale, California. I believed they loaned like a home movie of Larry when he lived in the old actor's home being interviewed like on a, you know, it was just like a Super 8 film. It wasn't for television or anything like that. And he was the most humble performer you can ever imagine. And when I saw him, he said something to the effect of, and he died when I was in high school, I know because I still have his obituary. But he said something to the effect of, you know, well, you know, he said our stuff has, you know, been out there or whatever, you know, for 40 years and people are still watching it. And so he said it must have been pretty good, but he was like dismayed by it. And that, by the way, even that interview was, you know, 30-something years ago, right? And he said that he liked to write to, he said he's got something like 150 letters a day. And he tried to write to everyone because he didn't want anyone to feel left out. It lit a fire in me when I heard him say this because I feel the exact same way with a fraction of the fame and ability. You know, and what I love, you know, there was Larry in the old actor's home with his, you know, snaggly teeth and his sticky outy hair slicked back and, you know, aged at that point. And he recognized that he had this experience that was, you know, rare air to breathe. And okay, I'm not Larry from the Three Stooges, but I share his love of this kind of work.
And it's interesting you brought up Larry from the Three Stooges, because I was going to ask you next about how you think comedy has changed over the years. I mean, you've been doing stand-up since, what, the late 70s, the early 80s? You're performing,
yeah.
When you think about performing in Champaign, when you're performing this weekend, how has it changed for you?
Well, by the way, I like it that you didn't even notice that so far I've compared myself to Larry from the Three Stooges and Beyonce.
I thought I would just let it go, because why not?
Which I think if anybody were to try to just pick some people that they thought kind of, you know, nailed me down, you know, well, you know, like in movies and television, in order to pitch to a network, like a pilot idea or an idea for a series or a movie, you know, there's they're so uncreative, the suits, that usually you have to say, well, it would be like Friends, but you have to use something that's already done in order to explain to them what you want to do.
Like Beyonce?
Precisely. So it's a little bit Beyonce, and it's a little bit Larry from the Three Stooges. I think you know what I mean.
Tracing the arc from Larry to you today, how do you think comedy has changed over the years?
You know, I don't know. You know, for me, because I work by myself now, I do theaters, and I'm so selfish that I do not have an opening act. And therefore, I don't really know a lot about what happens in the rest of the world of comedy. What I know is that my audiences are much the same as they've always been. As I said, I have people who say, oh, we saw you in this year, and we saw you in that year, and we saw you in this city, and we saw you in that city. So I have a core group of people that have been, you know, following me, thank goodness, for a long, long time. And then I'm always delighted when they say, you know, I brought my neighbor and she never saw you before. Here's my son. He never saw you before. That's always good news because it grows the herd a little bit. But
the Paula Poundstone, you know, family?
Yes, exactly. Oh, God, they don't want to be my family.
They don't want to be your family?
You know, whenever you go to a workplace and they go, well, we're like a family, I'm just, you know, my skin crawls. I go, oh, Jesus.
Okay, family and not in that way.
Yeah, I hide out at work. But I do feel that, me and a lot of my audience have been together for a long time, and I don't feel that. I mean, my act is largely autobiographical, and so I change what I say, because as I get older, you know, when I first started out, I talked about bussing tables and, you know, taking the bus and, I don't know, living in a 5-floor walk-up rooming house. And in more recent years, I talk about raising a house full of kids and animals. But it's still me talking. It's still me telling my own personal experience. I talk about politics here and there, not because I'm an expert on politics by any means, not because I'm a historian or a political analyst. I don't, you know, I'm barely hanging on with what the Electoral College is. Because I'm a voter and I try to pay attention to the news as well as I can to, and I'm dismayed by some things.
Well, and I was going to ask you, being dismayed by the news, I think, is probably something a lot of people have felt. But I also wonder about you being on Wait, you've been on hundreds of times. The big part of the show is kind of making jokes about the news. Do you think it's harder to be funny about the news when you're dismayed about it? Or also when the jokes are maybe even writing themselves? Because I feel like everybody feels like feels like they can make jokes about the Trump administration now. Like everyone's talking.
You know, it's shooting fish in a barrel sometimes. I mean, it's you can't even add on to what's already been done or said by the administration itself. Not just the administration either, by lots of people in politics and in political analysis right now. Largely it is partisan, in part because, let's face it, we are living in extraordinary times where, very unusual administration is in office. But the other reason why it's often partisan is because the Republicans are in power. And so, you know, those are the ones that have a lot of the airtime. And Trump, if he's a master at anything, it's at getting attention. And so, you know, his name is on everyone's lips. It's impossible. You know, people say to me, well, I don't know, you're a political comedian. Well, I don't know that I would call myself a political comedian, but we're steeped in it. We're drowning in it. We're, you know, I think Brides World magazine has a political page now. It's everywhere. And so, again, when I refer to stuff, and the great thing about Wait, is that because there's a bunch of us, for those who don't know, it's a weekly news quiz show made by NPR, and there are three panelists each week, and there's probably 15 panelists altogether, and we are shuffled about in no particular order that I'm aware of. But each panel that I've been on anyways in all these years, there's a lot of boxes checked. There are people much smarter than me that know much more about what's going on in the world, and, you know, they make jokes from that perspective. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, I make lots of jokes, but a lot of times I'm also, a lot of times I'm asking questions.
Well, you're also the person who, and wait, don't tell me, it seems like one of the things that comes up a lot are these ridiculous sounding scientific studies about pets or eating habits. And that brings me to your latest book, which is called The Totally Unscientific Study for the Search for Human Happiness. And it's sort of set up each chapter. You try a new scientific study that says this is what you should do to be happy.
I do. Each chapter is an experiment. Each one is written as an experiment, doing something that I or other people thought would make me happy. And
how did that turn out?
Well, I did learn a lot, actually. But I knew going in two things. I knew that the experiment itself, whatever I did, you know, one of them was backpacking with my oldest daughter. One of them was hugging everybody I met for a day. One of them was I rented a Lamborghini for a day. And I knew going in that the experiment itself would be a playground for jokes. And it was. I mean, the book's number one job is to be a funny book. But the real question for me wasn't whether I would enjoy doing something. The question was, what could I do that would give me like a bounce so that when I returned to my regular life of being a stand-up comic and raising a house full of kids and animals, that I would have, you know, that I would have some uplift, you know, some gas in the tank still, so to speak, you know, so that happiness had a little staying power is what I was looking for. And so the analysis part of each chapter, and I move in and out of the analysis and the field notes and the variables, et cetera, but the analysis part of each chapter was me checking back in with my regular life, and oftentimes so were the conditions, saying like, okay, you know, so I got back home, and then, you know, this I was dealing with this, this, and this. And so it's a kind of a sneaky memoir is what it is.
The science is something that you also talk about in a podcast that you had called Live from the Poundstone Institute. What was the thinking behind that in terms of you talked to a lot of scientists about weird studies then, too. I wonder how all of this came out.
Well, that came from just what you were referring to earlier about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You know, Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, will often, right, cite some study. I'm trying to think. One that I remember off the top of my head was, and they're always on different topics, but one of them was that cats were the only animal that don't forgive. And, you know, you just hear that, and so many questions spring to mind.
How did they know?
First of all, right. Know, how do you know when a rhino has forgiven you? And second of all, who the hell paid for that study?
Purina?
Honestly, right, in that case, probably, or just YouTube. You know, week after week when I'm on the show, they would say these studies, and every time I'd be like, wait, no, you have to explain that. I don't get it. I don't know why, you know, why can you say that that's a real thing? And the audience has enjoyed that over the years. And so, you know, one of the I went into a partnership with a bunch of producers from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And we made this podcast called Live from the Poundstone Institute, wherein I got to interview the actual scientists who do the studies. But that's where it came from. It came from Wait, Wait, and it was really fun to do.
It's a fun podcast. You can check it out for those of you who are not in the Champaign area and have tickets to see Paula Poundstone this evening at the Virginia Theater. Hey, Paula, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
It was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. If you want to look for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Robin Lynn and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.